A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the hidden architecture of global air freight. The hub-and-spoke model that moves everything from microchips to patio furniture. The mega-nodes where all that cargo converges. And whether those nodes look anything like the passenger airports we actually fly through. Are the big cargo hubs the same as the big civilian hubs? Or is there a parallel geography most of us have never seen?
The short answer is, it's a parallel geography. The busiest cargo airport in the world is Memphis, Tennessee. Not JFK, not Heathrow, not Dubai International, by a lot. Memphis handled 4.3 million metric tons of cargo in 2024. That's number one globally. Hong Kong is number two at 4.1 million. Anchorage, Alaska is number three. Anchorage, a city of about 290,000 people, moves more air cargo than Shanghai Pudong, more than Incheon, more than Frankfurt.
The box of electronics I ordered at 11 last night is probably routed through a city I'd struggle to find on a map.
Exactly the point. And here's what makes the architecture so counterintuitive. Passenger aviation is built around what travelers want, which is direct city pairs. You want to fly from Boston to Barcelona, the airline tries to get you there with maybe one connection at a major hub that's roughly on the way. Cargo doesn't care about any of that. Cargo wants maximum load factor. It wants consolidation. A box doesn't complain about a layover in Anchorage.
Cargo is the most patient traveler in the system.
The most promiscuous. A single shipment might touch three different carriers, two freight forwarders, and a customs broker before it reaches a distribution center. The entire logic is, gather everything at an origin hub, fill an entire freighter or a belly hold to capacity, fly it direct to another mega node, then break it apart and send it outward again. The trunk routes between the mega nodes are where the economics actually work.
The hub and spoke model in cargo isn't a compromise, it's the entire business model.
In passenger aviation, hub and spoke is a network strategy airlines use because they can't fill a plane on every city pair. In cargo, it's the only way the math pencils out. And the hubs are in places that make almost no sense if you're thinking like a tourist. Memphis exists as a cargo superpower because FedEx built its global super hub there, a 1,200-acre campus with 4 million square feet of sortation capacity. 300-plus flights arrive every night between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. The sort processes 1.5 million packages per hour.
1.5 million packages an hour.
The entire operation is timed so that a package arriving at 11:45 p.m. can be sorted, loaded onto an outbound plane, and airborne again by 4 a.m. It's the world's largest game of hot potato, played with $44 million worth of automated conveyor systems and about 11,000 employees working the overnight shift.
That's one company's hub. That's not even the public airport infrastructure.
It is, and it isn't. FedEx operates at Memphis International Airport, but the airport itself is effectively a landlord. The FedEx campus is a city within a city, and that pattern repeats. UPS has its worldport at Louisville, which handles about 2 million packages per night. DHL has Leipzig-Halle in Germany, processing over 2,000 tons per night, with automated sorters reading 50,000 barcodes an hour. These are not passenger airports that happen to have a cargo terminal bolted onto the side. They are purpose-built logistics machines.
When we talk about the mega nodes of air freight, we're really talking about two parallel networks that barely overlap.
That's the core insight. You have the integrated express carriers, FedEx, UPS, DHL, running their own dedicated hub networks with their own fleets, their own sortation facilities, their own flight schedules. And then you have general air freight, which is everything else. The pallets of industrial parts, the perishables, the fashion shipments, the electronics that aren't going through an express network. That freight moves in the bellies of passenger planes on trunk routes between major cities, or on dedicated freighters operated by carriers like Cargolux, Atlas Air, or Kalita.
Those two networks use different hubs.
Different hubs, different logic, different economics. The express carriers cluster around central sorting locations. Memphis, Louisville, Leipzig, Cologne, Bonn. The general freight network clusters around manufacturing centers and transshipment choke points. Hong Kong, Shanghai Pudong, Incheon, Dubai, Anchorage.
Anchorage keeps showing up in this list, and I have to say, a city in Alaska with a population smaller than Plano, Texas, being the third busiest cargo airport on Earth, is the kind of fact that makes me want to lie down.
It's the best example of why cargo geography is completely different from passenger geography. Anchorage is where it is because of physics. A fully loaded 747 freighter taking off from Shanghai can't make it to Chicago without stopping for fuel. The payload range curve doesn't allow it. You either carry less cargo, which destroys the economics, or you stop somewhere. And Anchorage is almost exactly on the Great Circle route between East Asia and North America.
It's a gas station.
It's the world's most strategically important gas station. About 90% of all cargo flights between Asia and North America stop at Anchorage. Ted Stevens International sees over 200 cargo flights a day, mostly wide-body freighters, 747s, 777s, MD-11s. The cargo apron stretches 2.5 miles. And here's the kicker. A huge portion of that cargo never clears U.S. Customs. It's transshipment. Planes land, refuel, sometimes swap cargo between flights, and take off again. The cargo might be on the ground for 90 minutes.
The fuel is cheaper there than in, say, Vancouver or Seattle.
Aviation fuel in Anchorage isn't subject to the same taxes, and the airport has invested heavily in making itself the most attractive refueling stop on the planet. Dedicated cargo ramps, ground handling optimized for 30-minute turns, and a geographic position that's impossible to beat without a longer-range aircraft that doesn't exist yet.
The Meganode list, and I want to make sure I have this right, is Memphis, Hong Kong, Anchorage, Shanghai Pudong, Incheon, Dubai, Louisville. And none of those are the big passenger hubs people actually know.
Dubai is the interesting crossover. Dubai International is a massive passenger hub, but the cargo operations are increasingly shifting to Dubai World Central, a newer airport built about 40 miles south of the city, designed specifically for freight. During the Red Sea crisis in 2024, when container ships were being diverted around the Cape of Good Hope and transit times from Asia to Europe jumped by 2 weeks, DWC became a pressure valve. Shippers shifted from ocean to air for high-value goods, and Dubai absorbed a huge amount of that volume because it sits at the intersection of Asia, Europe, and Africa.
Geopolitical crises reshaped the cargo network in real time.
Faster than passenger aviation, because cargo doesn't have the same regulatory inertia. If a shipping lane gets disrupted, freight forwarders can rebook onto air freight within days. The Red Sea crisis pushed air cargo volumes up by double digits month over month on certain lanes. Hubs like DWC, Istanbul, and even Liège in Belgium saw spikes because they had the capacity to absorb overflow.
Another city most people couldn't place on a map.
Liège Airport in Belgium is one of the great unsung cargo hubs of Europe. It's a freight-only airport, basically. No major passenger operations. But it's the European hub for several Chinese cargo carriers, and it handles something like 1 million tons of cargo a year. Zaragoza in Spain is the same story. A former military airfield that's become a major cargo node for southern Europe because it's uncongested, has long runways, and isn't competing with passenger slots.
The network is bifurcating. You have these freight-only airports emerging specifically because passenger hubs are too congested and too expensive for cargo operators.
Because the slot system at major passenger airports actively works against cargo. A freighter wants to land at 2 a.m., sit on the ground for 3 hours while the sort happens, and take off at 5 a.m. That's exactly when Heathrow, JFK, and Frankfurt are quiet for passenger operations, but still expensive to operate. Meanwhile, Liège will roll out the red carpet for that exact schedule. Lower landing fees, no slot restrictions, ground handlers who specialize in cargo turns.
The geography of air freight is a map of where passengers aren't.
Or a map of where manufacturing is, not where tourists go. Hong Kong is a cargo superpower because the Pearl River Delta is the world's factory floor. About 70% of the cargo that moves through Hong Kong International Airport is transshipment. It arrives from mainland China, gets consolidated, and flies out without ever entering Hong Kong customs. The airport is basically a sorting machine for southern China's exports.
Which makes Hong Kong the FedEx world port of the general freight world, minus the single company ownership.
Shanghai Pudong plays a similar role for the Yangtze River Delta. Incheon surged South Korea's electronics exports. The pattern is follow the factories, then find the geographic choke points between the factories and the consumers. The biggest passenger airports, JFK, Heathrow, Atlanta Hartsfield Jackson, they're massive people movers, but they don't crack the top 10 for cargo. Atlanta is the busiest passenger airport in the world and doesn't even make the top 20 for cargo.
Because nobody's manufacturing anything in Atlanta that needs to be flown to Shenzhen overnight.
They are, but not at the scale that justifies dedicated freighter capacity. Atlanta's cargo is mostly belly freight on Delta passenger flights. That's useful, but it's not the backbone of the network. The backbone is the dedicated freighters running between the manufacturing meganodes, stopping at the refueling choke points, and feeding into the sortation superhubs.
The prompt's question, are the major air freight nodes co-located with the largest civilian airports, has a pretty definitive answer.
Almost entirely no. There are a few overlaps. Dubai, Hong Kong, Incheon all have significant passenger operations. But the pure cargo nodes, Memphis, Louisville, Anchorage, Liège, Leipzig, Halle, Zaragoza, are places most travelers have never connected through and probably never will. They exist in a parallel aviation universe that moves 4.3 million tons of stuff through Memphis every year, while most people have no idea it's happening.
The consolidation mechanism that makes all this work, the freight forwarders, the containerization, the way a shipment from a small factory in Dongguan ends up on a 747 in Hong Kong, that's a whole layer of the network we haven't even touched yet.
That's the part that actually determines whether your shipment takes 3 days or six. The flying is the fast part. The consolidation and deconsolidation at each end is where the clock really runs.
We've mapped the mega nodes, but what actually happens inside one of these hubs when the nightly wave hits? Let's go inside Memphis.
To understand what happens inside Memphis, you have to understand why it exists in the first place. The hub-and-spoke model in air freight isn't just a routing preference, it's an economic necessity that emerges from a basic math problem.
Walk me through the math problem.
Imagine you're a carrier trying to connect 50 cities. If you fly direct between every city pair, you need 1,225 routes. Most of those planes would be half empty. But if you funnel everything through one central hub, you need 49 routes. Every plane is full. The cost per package collapses.
That's the consolidation logic.
That's the whole game. Consolidation means taking shipments from hundreds of different shippers. A crate of iPhones from Foxconn, a pallet of medical devices from Shenzhen, a box of sample garments from Guangzhou, and combining them into a single aircraft load. The freight forwarder does this at the origin hub. They're the middlemen who buy space on planes in bulk and resell it in smaller portions to individual shippers.
Like a group buy for air freight.
A forwarder like QAnon and Nagel or DHL Global Forwarding will book an entire pallet position or even a full freighter, then sell smaller allocations to dozens of clients. The shipment from that small factory in Dongguan that's only 3 cubic meters? It gets trucked to Hong Kong, consolidated with 40 other small shipments at the forwarder's warehouse near the airport, and loaded onto a 747 as part of a single unit load device, one of those aluminum containers you see on airport tarmacs.
Then it flies direct from Hong Kong to Anchorage to Memphis.
Or Hong Kong to Anchorage to Louisville, or Shanghai to Incheon to Leipzig, depending on whose network it's riding. The key is that the trunk route, the long-haul segment between meganodes, is direct. No stops, no detours. Maximum efficiency on the most expensive part of the journey.
This is where cargo logic diverges from passenger logic entirely.
A passenger wants to go from point A to point B with as few stops as possible. They'll pay a premium for direct. Cargo doesn't care about layovers. Cargo cares about cost per kilogram per kilometer. If routing through a hub 2,000 miles out of the way cuts the per unit cost by 30% because the plane is full, that's the route cargo takes. The box doesn't complain about the connection.
The box is the ideal airline passenger. No meal preferences, no bathroom breaks, doesn't mind the middle seat. But the trade-off is time. The consolidation step at the origin hub can add 12 to 24 hours. Deconsolidation at the destination hub adds another 12 to 24. So the 2-hour flight from Hong Kong to Anchorage, the 6-hour flight to Memphis, and the 1-hour hop to your local airport. That's 9 hours in the air and potentially 2 days on the ground.
Which is why air freight isn't always dramatically faster than ocean freight for non-express shipments. People assume air equals fast, But if you're shipping general freight, not FedEx overnight, but a pallet of industrial components, the consolidation buffer at both ends can stretch total transit time to 4 or 5 days. Meanwhile, a container on a fast ship from Shanghai to Los Angeles takes about 12 days on the water. The air freight saves you a week, not 3 weeks. You're paying a 10x premium for a 7-day advantage.
The network topology is feeder routes from small origins into the consolidation hub, a direct trunk route between meganodes, and then feeder routes back out to the final destinations.
The spokes feed the hub. The hubs connect to each other via the trunk. The destination spokes deliver to the end user. It's the same architecture that made FedEx famous in the 1970s, just scaled to global proportions. Fred Smith's original insight that a hub-and-spoke system with a single sorting center in Memphis could serve the entire United States overnight turned out to be the blueprint for global air freight.
The passenger aviation equivalent doesn't really have that middle layer. A passenger hub like Atlanta isn't consolidating. It's just connecting individuals who happen to be going to different places.
That's the distinction. A passenger hub is a transfer point for individuals. A cargo hub is a consolidation point for aggregated shipments. The passenger model is about connecting unique itineraries. The cargo model is about batching volume to maximize load factor. Different physics, different economics, different geography.
Which explains why the map looks the way it does. Memphis isn't a destination. It's a sorting machine with a runway.
That sorting machine works because the entire network is synchronized around a nightly pulse. At Memphis, the inbound wave hits between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. 300-plus aircraft arrive in a compressed window. The sort happens in a frenzy of automation. Conveyors, barcode scanners, tilt tray sorters, and by 4 a.m. the outbound wave is launching. The hub is empty by sunrise.
The network breathes. Inhale at night, exhale before dawn.
That rhythm is completely invisible to the passenger aviation world, which runs on a daytime schedule optimized for business travelers and vacationers. Cargo aviation is a nocturnal creature. It lives in the hours when passenger terminals are empty and the airspace is quiet. The two systems share runways at some airports, but they barely share a clock. That clock is what defines the meganodes. The top tier, by volume, Hong Kong handled 4.1 million metric tons in 2024, Memphis, 4.3 million, Shanghai Pudong, around 3.6 million, then Anchorage, Incheon, Dubai, Louisville.
Anchorage is the one that jumps out. The 47th largest city in the United States, and it's the third busiest cargo airport on the planet.
Purely because of where it sits on the globe. About 90% of all Asia to North America cargo flights stop at Anchorage. It's not a destination, it's a gas station with a sorting facility attached. Mostly wide-body freighters, 747s, 777s, MD-11s. The dedicated cargo apron stretches 2.5 miles. And the reason every flight stops there is a brutal physics constraint, payload range limits. A fully loaded 707 freighter taking off from Shanghai can't make it to Memphis nonstop. It's carrying too much weight to carry enough fuel, so it stops at Anchorage, refuels, and sometimes swaps out cargo while it's there.
The fuel is cheaper.
Duty-free, because it's inbound fuel for international operations. The airport has built an entire business model around being the world's most convenient refueling stop. Foreign cargo carriers can land, refuel, transfer cargo between planes, and take off again without the shipments ever technically entering United States customs territory.
Anchorage is a transshipment choke point disguised as a refueling stop.
It's not alone in that category. Dubai plays a similar role for Europe. Asia-Africa flows, sitting at the intersection of three continents with massive dedicated cargo infrastructure at Dubai World Central. Incheon does it for Northeast Asia. These are geographic inevitabilities. The great circle routes between manufacturing zones and consumer markets pass through them whether anyone planned it or not.
Memphis is not a geographic inevitability, though.
Memphis is a corporate creation. FedEx chose it in 1973 because it was centrally located in the U.S., had mild weather, and the airport authority was willing to play ball. Now the FedEx Worldport campus is 1,200 acres with 4 million square feet of sortation capacity. It processes about 1.5 million packages per hour during the nightly sort. The inbound wave hits between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. 300-plus aircraft arriving in a 3-hour window. Every package gets scanned, sorted, and routed to its outbound flight. By 4 a.m., the outbound wave is launching. The entire facility operates on what's essentially a reverse business day. The workday starts at midnight and ends at sunrise.
Louisville is the UPS version of the same idea.
Worldport in Louisville is slightly smaller but operates on the same nocturnal pulse. Between FedEx in Memphis and UPS in Louisville, those two cities handle the vast majority of overnight express packages in the United States. Neither city cracks the top 30 for passenger traffic. They are pure cargo constructs.
The answer to the prompt's core question. Are the biggest cargo airports the same as the biggest passenger airports? Is a resounding no, with about four exceptions.
Hong Kong, Shanghai Pudong, Incheon, and Dubai all have significant passenger operations alongside their cargo dominance. But even there, the cargo side operates on a different clock and often on different runways. And then you have the pure cargo nodes, Memphis, Louisville, Anchorage, Liège, Leipzig, Halle, that most travelers have never even heard of.
What makes Liège such a player? It's not a city that comes up in most conversations.
Liège is the perfect example of a freight-only airport. It's in eastern Belgium, away from the congested Brussels passenger hub, with a local government that aggressively courted cargo carriers. No slot restrictions, low landing fees, ground handlers who specialize in rapid cargo turns. TNT Express built their European hub there, and now it's a major node for the integrator networks. Zaragoza in Spain is the same story. Inditex, the parent company of Zara, uses it as their global distribution hub.
We're really talking about two parallel aviation systems that happen to share the same physics.
Occasionally the same runways, but never the same schedule. The passenger system peaks during daylight hours and moves individuals between major cities. The cargo system peaks between midnight and dawn and moves aggregated freight between manufacturing zones, geographic choke points, and sortation superhubs. They're visible to each other, but they're playing different games with different rules.
What about the belly freight factor? 60% of air freight by value rides in passenger planes.
That's the other half of the network, general air freight, as opposed to the express integrator model. General freight uses the belly space on passenger wide bodies flying between mega cities. That's the Hong Kong to London to New York flow. It's slower than the FedEx model because it's tied to passenger schedules, but it's cheaper because the plane is flying anyway.
That's where the forwarder consolidation really matters.
Because a passenger 777 isn't going to wait for your late shipment, the consolidation has to happen before the passenger departure window. The forwarder aggregates at the origin hub, delivers a consolidated unit load device to the airline, and it rides in the belly alongside passenger luggage. At the destination, a different forwarder deconsolidates and distributes. Two different network types, integrator and general freight, running on overlapping but distinct hub sets. And it's in that general freight path where the consolidation mechanism actually generates the cost savings. Let's follow one shipment through that path. Say you're a manufacturer in Wenzhou making electronic connectors. You've got three pallets. Not enough to fill a container, not enough to book a dedicated freighter. You call a freight forwarder, Kaney and Nagel, DB Schenker, someone like that.
The group buy organizer.
The forwarder consolidates your three pallets with 17 other small shipments at their warehouse near Shanghai Pudong. Now they've got a full unit load device, one of those aluminum cargo containers shaped to fit the curve of a wide-body fuselage. That ULD gets booked onto a passenger 777 flying Shanghai to Frankfurt. Your pallets ride in the belly, alongside suitcases and business class amenity kits.
The forwarder is essentially arbitraging the empty space,
taking a margin for the logistics coordination. At Frankfurt, a partner forwarder deconsolidates the ULD, separates the 20 shipments, and dispatches each one to its final destination. Your three pallets get trucked to Stuttgart. Total transit may be 4 days door-to-door, and you paid a fraction of what a dedicated air charter would cost.
The forwarder is the network layer that turns fragmented demand into consolidated load.
That layer is invisible to the end customer. You book with DHL or FedEx, but behind the scenes, a forwarder might be doing the actual consolidation. The integrators, FedEx, UPS, DHL Express, they own the entire chain. Their own aircraft, their own hubs, their own trucks, their own customs brokerage. General Freight is a patchwork of forwarders, commercial airlines, and ground handlers, all stitched together by airway bills.
Which is why the network is bifurcating. Two parallel systems that barely touch.
The bifurcation is accelerating. Look at what's happening in Europe. Liège Airport in Belgium. It's the fourth busiest cargo airport in Europe, and almost nobody outside logistics has heard of it. No passenger terminal to speak of. No duty-free shops selling Toblerone, just runways, cargo aprons, and sortation warehouses.
The anti-JFK. JFK exists for the theater of travel. Liège exists to move boxes.
Zaragoza in Spain is even more specialized. It's the European distribution hub for Inditex, Zara's parent company. Fashion logistics runs on a completely different clock than general cargo. A Zara garment goes from design to store in 3 weeks. The air freight network out of Zaragoza is tuned to that rhythm. Dedicated freighters flying to store clusters, not to cities.
Zaragoza is basically a private cargo airport for fast fashion.
Serving a single corporate supply chain, Leipzig-Halle in Germany is the DHL version, 2,000 plus tons per night, automated sortation reading 50,000 barcodes an hour. The facility is so large it has its own fire department and its own highway exit. It's a small city that exists to sort parcels.
50,000 barcodes an hour? That's a scan every 70 milliseconds.
The tilt tray sorters run at about 3 meters per second. Each package gets scanned on the fly, its weight checked, its dimensions verified, and it's routed to one of hundreds of destination chutes. If a barcode is smudged or missing, the system kicks it to a manual station where a human reads the label and keys in the destination. The tolerance for failure is essentially zero. A misrouted package in Leipzig becomes a delivery failure in Lisbon.
This all happens between midnight and 5 a.m.
The nocturnal pulse again. DHL's European network is synchronized so that the inbound wave from across the continent arrives at Leipzig between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. Sortation runs from 1 to 4. Outbound launches by 5. By 6 a.m., the packages are landing at destination airports across Europe, ready for morning delivery.
Leipzig is the Memphis of Europe.
With one key difference, Memphis is a single carrier hub. FedEx owns it. Leipzig is DHL's hub, but it also handles some third-party traffic. The integrator hubs are starting to blur at the edges as e-commerce forces more collaboration between networks.
Speaking of forcing changes, the Red Sea crisis in 2024, that was a stress test for this entire architecture.
A real-time experiment nobody wanted. When Houthi attacks forced container ships to reroute around the Cape of Good Hope, transit times from Asia to Europe jumped from 30 days to 45 or more. Suddenly, air freight looked cheap by comparison, not on a per kilo basis, but on a cost of stockout basis.
If your factory in Germany is about to idle because a component is stuck on a ship somewhere near Madagascar, you pay whatever it takes.
That's exactly what happened. Forwarders reported a 300% surge in air freight inquiries within weeks of the first attacks. Dubai World Central became a pressure valve. Cargo that would normally transit the Suez region by sea got flown into DWC, consolidated, and redistributed. The airport handled volumes it wasn't designed for, and the system held, but it revealed how brittle the ocean-to-air pivot can be.
Because you can't just flip a switch. The air freight network has finite capacity.
That capacity is mostly spoken for by existing contracts. The belly space on passenger planes is booked months in advance by forwarders with guaranteed allocations. When a crisis hits, the spot market goes insane. Rates from Shanghai to Europe tripled in a matter of weeks. Shippers who'd never used air freight before were suddenly bidding against each other for whatever space they could find.
The network is robust in normal conditions and fragile under shock.
Which is the paradox of hub and spoke generally. The architecture is incredibly efficient at steady state, maximum load factors, minimum cost per ton kilometer. But when a node fails or a route gets disrupted, the ripple effects propagate through the entire system. If Memphis gets hit by a severe thunderstorm during the inbound wave, every city in North America feels it by morning.
The passenger side has more redundancy built in. If JFK goes down, you can route through Newark or Philadelphia.
Cargo has fewer alternatives because the sortation capacity is so concentrated. You can't just redirect 300 FedEx flights to Nashville at 11:30 p.m. The automated sorters, the conveyor networks, the workforce, it's all purpose, built for that specific facility. The efficiency comes at the cost of fragility.
If you're a small business shipping internationally and you don't have a logistics department, how do you actually use any of that fragility? Knowing that Memphis exists is interesting, but does it change what you do on Monday morning?
It does, and the leverage point is the freight forwarder. Not all forwarders have the same hub access. A forwarder with a dedicated consolidation facility at Hong Kong International or a bonded warehouse adjacent to Memphis can shave 24 to 48 hours off your total transit time compared to one routing through a secondary node.
Because they're closer to the sortation pulse.
They're inside the pulse. A forwarder co-located at the Hong Kong cargo terminal can tender a consolidated ULD directly to a Cathay Pacific freighter without the intermediate trucking step. That trucking step, from an off-airport warehouse to the cargo apron, can eat an entire day, especially if you miss the cutoff window for the night's departure.
You're paying for proximity to the choke point.
The forwarders that have it charge for it, but the premium is usually less than the cost of the delay. If you're shipping from Shenzhen to Chicago, ask your forwarder whether they consolidate through Hong Kong or through a smaller regional airport. If they say Hong Kong, ask what their cutoff time is and whether they have on-airport consolidation. If they can't answer those questions, you're probably leaving a day or two on the table.
What about Memphis specifically? If I'm not a FedEx-scale shipper, can I still benefit from that hub?
FedEx offers a service called FedEx Consolidation, where smaller shippers pool volume through a forwarder partner that's co-located at the Memphis Superhub. Your package isn't big enough to justify a dedicated FedEx pickup to Memphis Lane, but aggregated with dozens of other small shippers, it rides the same MD-11 into the nightly sort. The forwarder handles the aggregation and hands it off to FedEx inside the fence.
You're essentially buying a seat on someone else's truck to the hub.
That's the whole game in logistics. The shippers who understand consolidation win on both cost and speed. The ones who don't end up paying retail rates for fragmented routing through secondary airports.
There's something else I want to flag for listeners, because it's one of those things you can't unsee once you know it. The next time you're at a small airport, or even just looking out the window on a long drive somewhere, and you see a cargo plane on the tarmac, you're not looking at a random delivery. You're looking at a strategic choke point.
Anchorage is the poster child for this. You land at Ted Stevens International as a passenger, and you see this endless row of 747 and 777 freighters parked on the cargo apron, a 2.5-mile stretch of wide-body jets that have nothing to do with the passenger terminal. Most travelers walk right past the window, glance out, and don't register what they're seeing.
They're looking at the physical manifestation of great circle geometry.
Duty-free fuel economics. That row of freighters is carrying something like $60 billion in goods at any given moment. Semiconductors, pharmaceuticals, automotive parts, fresh salmon out of Alaska riding back to Asia in the empty bellies. It's the most concentrated corridor of trade value in the sky, and it passes through a city of under 300,000 people.
Liège is the same story from a different angle. No passenger terminal, no travelers, no reason for anyone outside logistics to know it exists. But if you're in Europe and you see a 737 freighter on approach to a small airport in eastern Belgium at 3 in the morning, that's the global e-commerce network touching down in a cow pasture.
You can actually watch this in real time. Flight Radar 24 has a cargo filter. It's free, it works on a phone, and it's one of the most instructive things you can do if you're curious about how goods actually move. Toggle the filter to cargo only, zoom out to a global view, and watch the nightly wave build.
What time should someone tune in?
For Memphis, start watching around 10 p.m. Central. You'll see the inbound wave forming. Flights from Seattle, from Los Angeles, from Miami, from New York, all converging on a single point in western Tennessee. By midnight, the sky over Memphis is a constellation of descending freighters. Then around 3 a.m., the outbound wave launches and you see the reverse, a starburst of flights radiating out to every major city in North America.
A starburst of boxes.
The Asia-North America flow through Anchorage is visible too, though it's more spread out across time zones. You'll see a stream of freighters departing Hong Kong, Shanghai, Incheon, heading northeast on the Great Circle route, and almost every single one of them shows Anchorage as a waypoint. They land, refuel, sometimes swap crews, and continue to Memphis or Louisville or Los Angeles. The pattern is so consistent you could set your watch to it.
If you watch Leipzig around midnight, Central European time, you get the European version of the same pulse.
Same rhythm, different continent. The DHL fleet converging from every direction, the night sort, the dawn dispersal. It's oddly beautiful to watch, this completely invisible choreography that moves the stuff of daily life while almost everyone is asleep.
There is something satisfying about knowing the shape of the thing that delivers your things.
Once you know the shape, you start to see the vulnerabilities differently. The next time a supply chain story hits the news, a port strike, a fuel price spike, a geopolitical disruption, you'll have a mental map of where the pressure points are. You'll know to watch Anchorage for Asia, North America Flow, Liège for European e-commerce, Dubai World Central for Middle East transshipment. It turns abstract headlines into something you can almost see. And once you've seen that nightly wave, the obvious next question is whether this whole architecture has a shelf life.
If autonomous cargo drones and electric VTOL freighters actually become a thing, and Prometheus just raised $12 billion to build exactly that, do we still need the hub-and-spoke model for last-mile delivery, or does it go point-to-point?
I think it bifurcates further. The trunk routes between meganodes, Hong Kong to Anchorage to Memphis, those aren't going anywhere. The physics of payload range still favors consolidation at that scale, and a wide-body freighter carrying 100 tons of cargo at 40,000 feet is orders of magnitude more fuel-efficient than any drone fleet covering the same distance. But the last-mile leg, the 50 to 200-kilometer radius out of the hub, that's where point-to-point autonomy starts to make sense.
You'd have a 777 freighter landing at Memphis, and instead of a fleet of diesel trucks and feeder aircraft dispersing the packages, you'd have autonomous VTOLs launching from the edge of the sort facility.
You'd collapse the ground transit time from hours to minutes for high-priority shipments. Medical supplies, time-sensitive components, things where the delay cost justifies the premium. But it won't replace the trunk route. The economics of ton-kilometer at scale still favor the hub-and-spoke core.
The hub stays, but the spokes get smarter.
Or more autonomous, at least. The other thing to watch is where the next mega-node emerges. The current map, Memphis, Hong Kong, Anchorage, Dubai, Leipzig, reflects a manufactured geography that's shifting. If India becomes a larger share of global production, Navi.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.